Thank you, David. It's always nice to be introduced by friends, which is 100% the case here, I hope. One verse that you have probably heard many times that doesn't hold much terror for me, and I think it's supposed to, is Isaiah 3:12. And this is breaking right into the context, and God has told Isaiah some of the signs of terrible times. And in Isaiah 3:12, Isaiah says, and he's talking about bad times in Israel back then, but also coming. He says, youths oppress my people, women rule over them. I can understand the youth part. The older I get, the more I realize that young people are stupid. I don't really mean that, as you know. But I was stupid. I would not want you to have lived under my rule when I was 20 years old. I have my doubts at age 62 of what kind of a ruler I could be. I know there's a famous quote from Thornton Wilder that says, man's not worth anything till he's 40. Up till then, we just pay them to make mistakes. And I kind of feel that way about myself sometimes. But I've never had that much terror about women being their rulers. And I do understand the point here. If you go down further in the verse, these are terrible women. They're not described in glowing terms at all. But I think maybe part of it was growing up under the rulership of a woman named Margaret Graham, who we called Mom. And she ruled the ship pretty well. And also, I think when women are doing things the right way, some of them actually do, even in this world today, make pretty good rulers. And the reason I say that is I've had some bosses who are women who have been outstanding, just really fantastic. This comes at a time when men are being idiots and are either not ruling well or are abdicating rule. And the point here is that there's nobody to rule. And that, you know, even someone who as well spoken of as Deborah, in the Old Testament, she ruled because the men were all wimps at that time. She was the best man for the job. And this is a sign of the end time that women will rule over them. But as I say, I don't really have an inbred fear of that because some of the women who have been my bosses have been really very, very good leaders. I am grateful to have one now. She'll never hear this sermonette, so I don't think this could be classified as sucking up, but I just want you to know about this boss that I have because she taught me a very valuable life lesson. As many of you know, I have various sources of income, but mostly I'm a piano tuner. I tune them, repair them, voice them, make them sound good. I even play them and get paid to do it, which always makes me think that there's one born every minute, but whatever. A large part of my job is working on pianos, and I work in Berea, Ohio, at Baldwin-Wallace University. And this year, when the school year starts, every piano in the building will be either brand new or up to 2 years old. There's three exceptions to that. One is one piano that I own and the school doesn't own, and I'm keeping it. And the other two are cases where they're just very special pianos and the faculty members have said, I want that piano. So we've let them have that. But we have all new pianos. And one of the rules of leadership, which Mr. Thomas has not really brought to us, but I think he would acknowledge is a big part of leadership, especially at a university, is whatever you do, don't spend your own money. Spend other people's money if you can get away with it. I was at a meeting about 3 weeks ago where I spent multiple millions of dollars, one piano at a time. And at first I was quite nervous about it, but I got into it. It was quite fun. It was money that had already been pledged from an anonymous, well, not just pledged, we had it sitting in our account from an anonymous donor, and it was specified that this was to complete our campaign to become an all-Steinway school. And I have worked at this college for 23 years, and one of the problems at the school, they've always had good faculty, they've always had good students, good ensembles, good conductors, fairly good facilities. We have a pretty new building. But one of the things that was awful was the pianos, and it wasn't my fault. They were just very old, junky, used-up pianos. When a piano comes to our building, it gets worked on, it gets played, it gets beaten. We have a phrase we use called conservatory years, and a piano in your house might last 50 years, maybe even 100 years, longer than you will last. But a piano in a conservatory, if it lasts 10 years, that's a pretty good piano. Anyway, this woman, after 20 years of people failing to address this situation, the first week that she was our director, she called me into her office and said, "We're going to have new pianos." And I said, "Oh, okay," because that's what people had been telling me for 20 years. And she said, "I see this building full of brand new pianos with people excited to make good music on them." And she was telling me about the ways that would help the conservatory and the ways that would help recruitment, because as an all-Steinway school, we can attract the very top caliber of musicians, and we can. We can have events come in. We're now host to the Cleveland International Piano Competition, the youth division at this point. They had a very good experience. It was a very exciting time for us. These 12 to 18-year-old people, I hate to call them children because they played better than our faculty does. They were really good. And someone said, "Are you going to recruit them?" And the answer was, "Well, no, they already have a full ride to schools like Juilliard and New England Conservatory and other very good schools." It was just wonderful. But we can attract this kind of activity because we have that kind of pianos. It's wonderful. And I've been thinking about that a lot this week. She was gone for a week and came back. This week we just had 51 of the new pianos delivered. I think we only have 6 to go. So there's a lot of work to be done. But I remembered that time in her office 3 years ago, and I told her about it. I said, "You told me that this building would be full of new instruments and that you saw it happening and that you were going to find a way to make it happen." She saw the way the world was when she got there. She saw in her mind the way the world was in her dreams, what she wanted to happen. And the rest of it was just making it happen. It was very simple. All she had to do was get millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars donated from people. But somehow she did it. And I really take my hat off to this woman. As a matter of fact, I'm walking around the school these days in disbelief. They gathered all the old pianos in one of our big auditoriums, and they were all sitting there, and I thought, well, out of respect for the deceased, I really should go in and pay my respects. So I went in, and I sat down, and I looked at them, and I was waiting for a great flood of emotion to come over me, and as it sat there, it didn't happen. I was just laughing and laughing. I'm thinking, goodbye. Go away. You know, this is great. We've got brand new piano. So it's been impressed on me what a powerful, powerful tool visualization is. Now, it doesn't mean, of course, that just because you wish for something that it can happen. I remember somebody said to me once, you know, "Well, there's going to be a rainbow because I believe there's going to be a rainbow." Well, there wasn't a rainbow. And of course, that's not how rainbows happen. Rainbows happen because of the sun and water vapor and things like that. It's not just because you want things to happen that they happen. But if there's something that is humanly achievable, a very powerful tool for achieving that is visualization. You see it the way that it should be. You examine closely the difference between the way it is and the way that you want it to be. And then, as Susan said, it's just a matter of making it happen after that. And of course, you know, that's a joke, because it's a phenomenal accomplishment to make it happen. There was a lot of work that went in the last 3 years to make it happen. But this woman had the tools, and she had the skills to talk to people, and I'm a believer. I've always believed in this, I suppose, with some part of me, but just to see it happen that way, and you look at life, and you realize that visualization is a large part and a really important tool for people living God's way of life, both in living today in this world as it is and in thinking in terms of the world tomorrow. Visualization is a tool that's very valuable, and it can brighten our lives, but it can also accomplish real and tangible things. The world is a certain way. The reality of the world is that people have to grow food. People have to work to grow food. People have to build houses. People have to wear clothes. People have to do all kinds of things. You have to have jobs. If you have children, you have to provide for them. If you have a family, you have to provide for them. If you have older parents or people in your family who need care, you have to provide for them. There are many woes in this world. It's been called a veil of tears in some way. Thankfully, God has put enough blessings and good things in it, especially this time of year, you know, when the tomatoes are ripening and the flowers are blooming and the birds are singing. It's easy to believe in the good side of life, but there's also a lot of bad, and it's very important for us to think of the good and to visualize that good. Part of my life at Baldwin-Wallace University is I work very closely with the theater department and the music theater department, and theater department is almost nothing but visualization. It's just people getting paid unbelievable amounts of money to play make-believe. And, you know, they pay people to paint the backdrops and make the costumes, but really they're just pretending. They know it. That's why they're called plays. But you know, it's just a matter of visualizing. And they say, well, good theater can change your life. And if you've ever been to a show that's had a big effect on you and you've walked out, you can be uplifted or dejected, but you can be deeply affected by that kind of make-believe, because when you work hard to bring to life an imaginary situation, to visualize it, to make it come to life, it can have a big effect on your mind and all that you do. All art really is a form of visualization, even if it's not a visual art. All art is looking at the world the way the artist wants it to be, to have some kind of effect. Sometimes it can be abstract and do a direct connection with just feelings and reactions and the way light plays. Sometimes it can be very specific. I'm sure you can all think of paintings that tell a story. I remember seeing a painting in the Norton Simon Museum across the Colorado Boulevard from the Ambassador College campus in Pasadena that still has an effect on me. And I didn't know what the painting was. There was an older gentleman, and when I say an older gentleman, maybe 40-ish, 50-ish, something like that, but not a 20-year-old. He had gray hair and a beard, and he was holding a little baby, and you could barely see the baby. You couldn't see the baby's face, but you knew that there was this baby, and this man had the strangest expression on his face. He was obviously holding a baby for the first time, and it was sort of a smile, and it was sort of fear, but somehow the artist had captured it so beautifully. And my wife and I went up and looked at the caption on the painting, and it said, Joseph and Jesus. And that's always struck home to me. Just that, who would have thought, you know, Joseph was an older man, and this was the first baby in his household. And it just captured both the sweetness and the humor of the situation. And by visualizing it, you know, it can really make things come to life. Good literature is that way. I know sometimes people say, oh, I don't read fiction because it's lies. Well, I got news for you. Jesus Christ taught with fiction. They were called parables. They were things he made up because he knew that by visualizing these things, you could understand them in different ways. Even music and dance, things that aren't terribly visual, although dance has, of course, a visual component to it, can have quite an effect on people. It's a real shorthand for visualizing. Music's very dear to me as an avenue to people's minds, as a way to change their minds about things or make them feel certain ways or just tell stories that will change their life. It's amazing what you can do with music. Well, why not? I wasn't going to do this, but suppose I say to you, the man rode up to the castle and you hear this music in the background. You get a certain image, don't you, of the guy shouting, riding up on his steed. If you hear this in the background, you know that it's either the tax collector or the undertaker. You don't know what's happening. And if you hear, sorry, I will pay for that. I keep forgetting that things are recorded here. But visualization in our lives is very closely connected with faith. Visualization in all that it means and faith are very closely related. If you turn to Hebrews 11, which is maybe the book of the Bible that says the most about faith, if you turn to Hebrews 11, the chapter known as the faith chapter, and just read the first verse, I'm reading out of the New International Version, but it rings true, I think, from translation to translation. This says, "Now faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. This is what the ancients were commended for. By faith we understand that the universe was formed at God's command, so that what is seen was not made out of what was visible." And regardless of how you believe the universe was made, you weren't there. Not even Mr. Thomas was there at that point. Doesn't matter how old you are, you're a lot younger than the universe. You weren't there, and yet you believe that the universe was formed somehow. Regardless of what you believe, everybody on Earth believes that the universe was formed. We have faith in believing that God formed the universe. There's many roads that he could have taken to do it, but we take it on faith. Just about everything we believe on faith. We've never seen Jesus Christ. We've never heard Jesus Christ speak to us directly. Maybe Mr. Thomas knows people who have. If he knows eight of the two witnesses, it's quite possible. But you know what I mean. Sane people have not heard Jesus Christ speak to them. And yet, we believe in Jesus Christ. We believe in the details about his life. We believe that his life made a big difference. We believe his teachings, and we believe that his teachings are important because of who gave the teachings. Faith is a matter of hoping for things in many cases and for believing things that we do not see. It's a form of visualization. The reality of what we call our beliefs or our religion is, in a way, not real life at all. We believe in things that are going to happen. We believe that things have happened, and we apply them to the things that are happening in our life, and we live a certain way because of the things that we believe and the things that we can see clearly in our mind. Our whole approach to God's way of life, in some respects, is based on visualization, the difference between the way things are and the way they should be and how to get there. The weekly Sabbath, in a way, is a form of theater. In a way, it's a form of visualization. It doesn't really affect God one way or another if you keep the Sabbath or you don't. God has told us to keep the Sabbath, and he has said that he takes pleasure when people are keeping his commandments, and one of his commandments is to keep the Sabbath. So to say that it doesn't affect him might be an exaggeration, but you know what I mean. Whether we keep the Sabbath or whether we don't keep the Sabbath, God's life goes on just fine, one way or the other. So does Jesus Christ. And yet, it makes a difference. We take one day out of the week, and not just any day out of the week. We take a specific day out of the week. We take the seventh day, because the seventh day symbolizes that God made the earth in 7 days. So we're visualizing that in the past. And it also symbolizes that after a time of man, there will be a rest at the end. It's called a rest. And so by keeping the Sabbath, we are visualizing that, and it helps us to live. The Sabbath gives us that kind of strength. Other people wonder what you're doing and why it matters to you. And unless you keep the Sabbath, it's difficult to explain to people how important the Sabbath is. And once you start keeping it, I'm sure you're like me. It will always be a part of your way of life. And it's not a question of whether you're going to keep it or not. It's a very important part of your life because all your beliefs hinge on that day of rest and God's coming day of rest, and that God made the earth in 7 days. We're acting out, in a way, what is to come. Even the things that we do at Sabbath services, it's a very artificial thing. We gather from all walks of life. We're not a natural gathering in some ways. We come to this building, which is an unusual building. I mean, if you've never seen a church before, a church building, you might come in and wonder what kind of things it was used for. We've had people ask what that hole is back there. That was where people were baptized when this was a Baptist church, and you could see that kind of thing. So this building visualized various uses. We use it today just as a meeting hall, But to us, it's kind of a normal thing. And yet, there's all kinds of abnormal things about it. I've gotten more questions, having grown up a good Presbyterian, about what are those things in front of you with the three holes in them? And I've explained to people that what those are is you take your three middle fingers and you hook them in there, and it helps you stand up to sing the hymns. That's what those are for. They're for communion cups. You know that. Please tell me you know that. But I have found out during really gripping sermons, they can stabilize you too. It's really, really kind of nice that way. But they have all kinds of details that are just not a normal part of real life. I stand up here and I go, blah, 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 blah. You sit out there, many of you are even awake, and you listen to the things I say, and the goal is for me to take what's in here, which came out of God's mind but through human minds, and to put it through my mind and to put it through the air to make the air vibrate. I move certain parts of my body up here. The air vibrates. You have little drums in your ears that are going like this, and it translates through nerves and hairs and things into your brain. And somehow, hopefully, the knowledge is imparted. Talking is a really complex, wonderful thing when you think about it. But it's not a normal thing for this many people to just sit and listen to one person for a long time. It's something that we choose to do because we feel that there's a benefit in it, and it will help us live better and help us to grow to be God's family better. That's why many times we have videos. Remember that nature video where the women sang a song and Mr. Blakey sang a solo, but there was just gorgeous natural photography behind it? And it really drove the music home because that kind of thing, to be able to see all the miraculous things. I can stand up here and tell you what God has done, but to actually be able to see the beauty of the colors and the shapes and the motions and all the things that are going on in the earth really makes a difference. Music, of course, as I explained, is a big part of our services, and yet that's in some ways a form of visualization. Very little else in our beliefs matches the level of visualization that takes place when we observe the holy days. The holy days are a very unusual thing, and you don't really understand how unusual and how important they are until you actually keep them. Again, you can talk to people about holy days, and you can explain why they're important, but I think many of you would agree, in the history of our own church, we had no understanding of the holy days until we kept them. And with God's Holy Spirit, we were able to understand the meaning and see how that the life of Christ and the life of individual children of God plays out in those holy days. And yet, the events of Israel leaving Egypt, the events of the first Passover, the events of Jesus Christ returning are things that we haven't seen. We believe in them. The events of the Feast of Tabernacles, where a city is built, where a world is built, where we all keep God's laws and work together and live in happiness and harmony, in a big contrast to the horrible way things are in parts of the world and parts of our own lives today, is a visualization. That's why we take major parts of our income and spend it on plane trips and spend it on food and spend it on clothing. We even spend it on toys. We spend it on, sometimes we spend it on alcohol. You know, when we first used to go to the feast in Squaw Valley, I think the biggest line, this was back in the 70s, was at the liquor store in town in California. Every state's different. But you'd go there and you'd see the church people standing in line outside the liquor store. Then, as time went by in our family, our first visit at the feast was Toys R Us. Now, it wasn't our first visit to Toys R Us. We'd done reconnaissance at Toys R Us. But it wasn't until the feast that we actually went to Toys R Us and spent our money. But these things helped our kids to understand the happiness that was involved. I remember one time we bought a toy and brought it home, and then we saw a better version of it at a store. And our first impulse for Tay and me was to say, well, you know, we'll just live with what we have because it's way too much trouble. And then I thought, what am I saying? It was something for David, and I remember the look on his face, and I said, yeah, we'll take it back and we'll get this one. And he said, really? I said, yes. I said, it's the only time of year I can buy happiness. I'll do it. And he was happy, and it did make a difference. And even though like, our children don't attend, but they associate the Feast of Tabernacles with happiness. And then as we moved on, we developed a tradition that wherever we went, usually the day before opening services when it wasn't a Sabbath. Sometimes we did it on the second day of the feast, but we would find a local Walmart. And Walmart doesn't sound like paradise, but we would go in and we would get a cart and we would say, whatever you want. You know the rules, but whatever you want. And I remember the first time we did that, our kids, who knew us well and knew how tight-fisted we were with all kinds of things, just they couldn't get into it. It was like, you don't really mean that. And we said, yeah, we do. And they would say, even clothes? Even clothes. Even candy? Even candy. It's the Feast of Tabernacles. It didn't take them too long to get into it. Well, as adults, we do the same thing. We even, there are clothes that are called festival garments because they help us feel good about ourselves and they bring happiness not to us, but in many cases to other people who get to see the beautiful clothing and things. It's entirely appropriate. We do all kinds of things. And yet, as Paul says, it's really just a shadow. It's not the real thing. We're pretending at that point. Now, we're pretending very earnestly, and we're pretending because God told us to do it. But as you keep the holy days, you realize that they tell the whole plan of God from beginning to end, not just the history of what God is doing, but the history of the journey of each individual member of his family. From the time that you're called out and redeemed by God, and you put away sin, and you receive his Holy Spirit, and then you partake in the things that are still yet to come. Those things have taken place already in the lives of many of you. And yet, in just a few short weeks, we're going to be gathering and going literally all over the globe to pretend that the world tomorrow is here. And the reason we do it is, A, God tells us to, but B, we can learn beautiful, beautiful lessons. C, it's also a whole lot of fun. But we'll dwell on the B at that point. Our main visualization, the thing God keeps putting in front of us, might surprise you. What I would call the number one visualization that God brings to us through his word and in his way of doing things might surprise you. And furthermore, you don't have to agree with me. I'm just going to put it out there. I think that the main thing that we ought to be thinking about in terms of God and his way of life and what he is doing is a city. And I have reasons for thinking that. We were just in Wisconsin. We visited our daughter and her husband. We visited my brother up there. And we had the opportunity to go to Frank Lloyd Wright's home. You can call it his home, but actually it's acres and acres of estate up there. It's a community that he tried to build. And it's very inspiring to go to a place like that. The place where I work in Berea is designated as a lyceum. A lyceum is an attempt for people to build a utopia. The lyceum got started in the early 1800s, and by the mid-1800s, it had already failed miserably, I can tell you. But it's still fun to see the signs that people tried. Frank Lloyd Wright was a horrible man. The more you find out about him, he was a really good architect. He said he was not only the best in the world, but the best the world would ever see. I mean, he just had no problems visualizing himself that way. It was a tool that he used. But he drew up plans for a whole community and a whole city there and a form of education. He was pals with the man I'm very interested in, Elbert Hubbard, who did the same kind of thing in Western New York. It's instructive and interesting to go see the Roycroft community in East Aurora, New York, because that is one of the most successful communities. The reason that one stands out is that Elbert Hubbard and his people made enough money to pay all their bills, as opposed to Frank Lloyd Wright, who still owes people money, and he's been dead for decades now. And they still talk about him that way, too. Another man that saw a city and he wanted to build it was, of all people, Walt Disney. When you go to Florida and you go to Walt Disney World, you see many wonderful things. But it's easy to forget that Epcot was plans for a planned community where people would live, and they would grow, and they would celebrate, and they would work. It was meant to be a city. That part of it never really came to fruition. Other parts of it did, and we can still marvel at it, but these men all saw a city. Mr. Thomas pointed out to me when we were talking about Frank Lloyd Wright that Herbert Armstrong was a builder of cities. That in our church history, we actually had three communities. We called them campuses because that was an easy way to get a handle on what they were. And they did have colleges, but they were also communities. They were places that people flocked to and came to live and gardened and ate together and worked together and dreamed together. and visualized things together. Of course, those have all faded now, and none of that is left. And yet, we still need to see that city that God puts before us. Abraham saw that city back in Hebrews 11 again. You might still be there because we haven't gone anywhere since then. But in Hebrews 11, in verse 10, it speaks very specifically about Abraham, and it says, "For he was looking forward to the city with foundations, whose architect and builder is God." He saw that city before him. So did other people. From verses 13 to 16, the writer of Hebrews says, all these people, many names that he's gone through, all these people were still living by faith when they died. In other words, there were things that they could see in their minds that didn't exist, that they believed in, and it governed their lives. They did not receive the things promised. They only saw them and welcomed them from a distance, and they admitted that they were aliens and strangers on the earth. People who say such things show that they are looking for a country of their own. If they had been thinking of the country they had left, and of course some of these people, Abraham, Moses, they did leave countries, they would have had opportunity to return. Instead, they were longing for a better country, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. That's the way God sees the end product, a community of people who are his family and who are living the way that he wants them to live. Abraham could see this. We don't know if Abraham kept the holy days. He might have, because he lived God's way and he was righteous. But we also know that God spoke to him, and God gave him what? Visions. Why did God give visions? So Abraham and other people who received visions could see what God was talking about. God gave Enoch visions. We know this because in the book of Jude, Jude quotes Enoch. And Enoch has a very vivid vision of Jesus returning and what will happen when that comes. So whether these people kept the holy days or not, they understood the story. They knew what God was doing because God gave it to them. And it says three places in the Bible that Abraham believed God and it was counted to him as righteousness. And, of course, this city vision, as you read verses 13 and 16, applies to all God's people who have faith. The nation of Israel, I don't know if you ever thought of it this way, but the nation of Israel was meant to be a visualization of God's way of life. That's why things were different, because some things applied to a very specific experiment. And you read God's reasons for establishing the nation of Israel, and by that, I mean, there's still a nation of Israel today, but I mean the kingdom of the descendants of Jacob, that nation of Israel. God often uses the phrase that the nations may see, that the nations may see. And you get the feeling that his hope was that people would turn to his way of life simply because of this city, this nation that he set before them. 2 Chronicles 9 is a demonstration of this. There's certainly other places in the Bible to talk about this kind of thing, but this was Israel at its acme. 2 Chronicles 9. It was under the days of Solomon, and not only was the kingdom very rich, but one of the things that we don't think about very often was that the kingdom also was at peace. The people were so dazzled by this kingdom, and of course David had spent a lot of time fighting and subduing different rebellions and people who wanted to conquer Israel, that was still very much in people's minds. But Solomon didn't fight wars. Let's read 2 Chronicles 9. Talk about a visualization. This is specifically the time when the Queen of Sheba came to visit. When the Queen of Sheba heard of Solomon's fame, she came to Jerusalem to test him with hard questions, because that was his superpower, was wisdom. Arriving with a very great caravan, in other words, she was making an entrance. She was doing some visualization here. She was showing Israel what she was made of. With camels carrying spices, large quantities of gold and precious stones, she came to Solomon and talked with him about all she had on her mind. Solomon answered all her questions. Nothing was too hard for him to explain to her. When the Queen of Sheba saw the wisdom of Solomon, as well as the palace he had built, the food on his table, the seating of his officials, the attending servants in their robes, the cupbearers in their robes, and the burnt offerings he made at the temple of the Lord, she was overwhelmed. It says in some places her spirit went out of her, her breath went out of her. She couldn't believe how magnificent it was. And of course, This peak of Israel's prosperity and peace only lasted for a short time. Verse 5, she said to the king, "The report I heard in my own country about your achievements and your wisdom is true, but I did not believe what they said until I came and saw with my own eyes. Indeed, not even half the greatness of your wisdom was told me." Interesting that that's the main thing she was impressed with. "You have far exceeded the report I heard. How happy your men must be, because God's city is a city of happiness. How happy your officials who continually stand before you and hear your wisdom. Praise be to the Lord your God, who has delighted in you and placed you on his throne as a king to rule for the Lord your God. Because of the love of your God for Israel and his desire to uphold them forever, he has made you king over them to maintain justice and righteousness." Then she gave the king large quantities of wonderful things. And in the rest of the chapter, it talks about Solomon's splendor and his house and the house for God. And in verse 22, it says, "King Solomon was greater in riches and wisdom than all the other kings of the earth, and all the kings of the earth sought audience with Solomon to hear the wisdom God had put into his heart. Year after year, everyone who came brought a gift, articles of gold and silver and robes, weapons and spices and horses and mules." In verse 27, "The king made silver as common in Jerusalem as stones and cedar as plentiful as sycamore fig trees in the foothills." It was such a prosperous thing that all the world, even in an age where they didn't have the internet, where communication was very slow, the word got out. The city of Israel, the nation of Israel, was a visualization for the whole world to see. We know that it didn't work. God put a lot into that experiment, and it didn't work. He had, of course, another plan. The nation of Israel knew, by the way, that they were this city. If you read in Psalms 48, Psalms 46, and Psalm 107, there's quite a bit of talk and singing in the temple about the city of God. They knew, partly at least, what their experiment was about. Well, a city is still to come. And when I say a city is coming, I'm talking about a city that's coming before Christ returns. The whole book of Haggai talks about that, about the building of a community in the future. If we turn to Isaiah 61, you know these verses very well. These are things that have to happen before Jesus returns. When Jesus was on earth, he read the first verses. He said, "The Spirit of the Sovereign Lord is on me." I'm in Isaiah 61, verse 1. "Because the Lord has anointed me to preach good news to the poor, he has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim freedom for the captives, and to release from darkness for the prisoners, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." And that's how Jesus inaugurated his own work on earth. And he angered people because they said, "How can you, a son of a carpenter, say that you're doing all those things?" Well, the rest of it is for another time. Let's keep reading the last part of verse 2. "And the day of vengeance of our God, to comfort all who mourn, and to provide for those who grieve in Zion, and to bestow on them a crown of beauty instead of ashes, the oil of gladness instead of mourning, a garment of praise instead of a spirit of despair. They will be called oaks of righteousness, a planting of the Lord for the display of his splendor." Verse 4, "They will rebuild the ancient ruins and restore the places long devastated. They will renew the ruined cities that have been devastated for generations." And you think that's talking about the world tomorrow, and it is possible that that is. But there are similar verses in Jeremiah 30. Jeremiah 30 talks about a community. Let's start in verse 18. Jeremiah 30, "This is what the Lord says, I will restore the fortunes of Jacob's tents and have compassion on his dwellings. City will be rebuilt on her ruins. The palace will stand in its proper place. From them will come the songs of thanksgiving and the sound of rejoicing. I will add to their numbers and they will not be decreased. I will bring them honor and they will not be disdained. Their children will be as in days of old and their community will be established before me." Now read the next phrase. "I will punish all who oppress them." This is not the world tomorrow. This is a community, a visualization of God's way of life that will exist. And in verse 22, the Lord says, "So you will be my people and I will be your God." He says in verse 21, "Their leader will be one of their own. Their ruler will arise from among them. I will bring him near and he will come close to me. For who is it who will devote himself to be close to me?" This is not Jesus. This is something on earth. And then verses 23 and 24, talk about the fierce anger of the Lord that comes after this community is established. So this has to happen before Jesus returns, that kind of visualization, that city. It's really just a picture of what will come in the world tomorrow, though still, it's still, even though it's a real city, just a visualization. You know in Revelation 12, you can turn there on your own time, but in Revelation 12, we have a church myth, legend, whatever you want to call it. And myths and legends can be true, but as part of our church storytelling, there's a thing called the place of safety. And we talk about that because it's an interesting thing to talk about. Everybody wants to be there. You don't want to be outside it. But this place of safety will be a city in the wilderness, a community that will last 3.5 years, and it'll be there before Jesus returns. The end of that community is when Jesus returns and establishes his own kingdom. And so all these things are talking about the same thing. In the book of Haggai, it describes this community. You know, there are those of us who talk about the glory of days gone by in our church. We shouldn't talk about it that much because there's a bright future ahead. But one of the things that God says in Haggai is that the second glory before Jesus returns will be greater than the first. We can't even comprehend it, but it's there. And when it happens, I hope God's Spirit helps me to see it and to know what it is. Well, you know the famous verse in Proverbs 29 and verse 18. Where there is no visualization, the people perish. That's a misquote, of course. It says, where there is no vision, the people perish. We need vision to live God's way. I am a great respecter of vision. I think Mr. Thomas has shown us vision in many things. When we were getting a church building, he led us to this blessing. I think he deserves a great deal of respect for that, for having that kind of vision. There are other people in our church who have visions of doing things in the community, of doing things right here, who quietly do things for others. All those visions are very important. I very much admire the vision that my own boss has and the way she has made it come true. And there's a whole lot more to her vision. And because these pianos have happened, I'm kind of getting excited about the other things. I'm kind of wondering if I want to retire in 4 years. I'm pretty sure I know how that'll turn out. But at the same time, there's exciting things happening, and it's so encouraging to be able to say to students, you won't believe what a great place you're coming back to, how things have changed for the better, and boy, it all seems good to me. And I'm not just talking about pianos. They're always trying to change things for the better. The Republicans that gathered in Cleveland this week all had their own vision. Some of it was murky. Some of it was clear. Some of it was easy to understand, and those were the people who stand out, the people who could put their vision before you and make you want to be a part of it. And that's what a candidate wants to do. A candidate wants to show you what they have in mind, what they see, and hopefully what you see and what they see coincide enough that you want to be part of that. That's what these candidates are doing. In some respects, the measure of a leader is their vision, because the rest, as my boss says, is just making it happen. And of course, that can be a Herculean task, but at the same time, the vision is what starts it. What should our vision be? I say our vision should be a city, a world where things are done God's way. And of course, there is so much more to God's story. I know we hear a lot about Jesus Christ's sacrifice, so important, about Jesus Christ's ministry on earth, so important, about being cleansed by his blood, so important. And yet in some ways, those things just lead up to the doors of the city. That's just the way that you get there. And that's why God talks about the city now, as it's what's on his mind. It's what's to come. The coming terrors that will come, a warning to the whole world, yes, very important. But that's just what happens before the city. And sometimes you can get people's attention that way. But the way you keep their attention is to plant a beautiful world tomorrow in front of them and have them want to pin their whole lives on that coming. Do you remember your own excitement when you knew that that was in your future, when you knew that God had called you to all that goodness? When you think about it, you know, one of the things that really separates us from other people, just not in terms of the way we live our lives, but in terms of just physical things that we do, is the keeping of the Sabbath. Our sign out there says, Saturday services, 12:30. That's what distinguishes, that's what people see. Plus, you don't eat the shrimp hors d'oeuvres at Bald Wallace University. We are a Sabbath-keeping group. and we keep it on a seventh day. Would it make any difference at all if we kept it on the first day of the week? Yes, it would make a lot of difference. It's very important. It's not just one day in seven. It's the seventh day. And it matters because the vision is different. The things that are attached to the first day of the week, even if you don't want to get into all the other origins of it, even from a Christian cant, the things that are attached to the first day of the week are the resurrection and rising out of the tomb, supposedly. Now, we know that that's even questionable and suspect. That's not part of our beliefs, but that's why they call it the day of the Lord. And there's no future in that. So what? Okay, it happened. It's a very important part of the story. But the future, what God is doing, that he created the world long time ago, and that he's going to create the world again, the restoration of all things in the near future, that's attached to the seventh day. That visualization that we do every week, we take time out, we duck out from the world. People don't always know where we are. We sort of hide, but we gather together in a refuge together, and we hear about what God is going to do. Everything we think we know, all the things we think we know about God's plan are in some ways just a beginning. And that's why the last holy day of the year has to be vague, because we don't really know what's going to happen. I'm going to call it the last great day. You know, it's the eighth day. There's 7 days of the Feast of Tabernacle, and then there's a high day. And I'm calling it the last great day simply because that's what we call it on our church calendars. It still says that in print. And so that's what I mean, that eighth day. We have trouble talking about that eighth day because we don't know all that it entails. And everything that we do know about the sacrifices that Christ has made, everything that he's done for us, about the things that we do in this life here, about our journey on earth between the time we're born and the time we physically die, is just leading us up to the door of the city. We have so much to learn. We have so much to learn about getting along with people, about ruling people, about inspiring families, about being a family. It's going to go on for all eternity, and you think, well, you know, after the first few months, I think I'll have it down. That's not the way it's going to be. Of the increase of his kingdom and government, there shall be no end. It will go on for all eternity, and we just don't know. The author of Hebrews, the book of Hebrews, which we've already read parts of, I love the book of Hebrews because it covers territory that other books don't necessarily cover, or if it's the same territory, it's a different perspective. It's one of the reasons that I don't think Paul wrote it, although he might have, and there are good reasons to think he did. So I just call him the author of Hebrews, because to me the perspective is so different. But he talks a lot about Jesus Christ being the high priest and sacrificing and how important that is. And yet, what does he end up with? In Hebrews 13, how does he sum up the vision and the visualization? In Hebrews 13 and verse 14, he has just talked about Jesus suffering outside the city gate to make people holy through his own blood. So that's definitely part of the story. But in verse 14, he ties it all together by saying, "For here we do not have an enduring city," here meaning on this earth, "but we are looking for the city that is to come." He's echoing, he's singing the chorus that he has sung all the way through the book of Hebrews, that there is a city to come and we are looking for it, just like our father Abraham did. What was God's last gift of Scripture to his people? When you think about it, Jesus' cousin and best friend on earth, John, was elderly and was captive on the on an island, on a Greek island of Patmos, when Jesus Christ, it doesn't say God, it says Jesus, his friend and his cousin, gave him the vision of the book of Revelation. But if you look at the end of the book of Revelation, of course, this was to give encouragement to people who in that first century had already been through death, destruction, persecution, that our own lives don't compare to it at all. God leaves them with a beautiful vision. Jesus leaves them with a vision in chapter 21 and verse 1. "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea. I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride beautifully dressed for her husband." And that's why it's called a heavenly city. It comes from heaven. But it will be something that we dwell in with God. And you read the beautiful things in chapters 21 and 22, how God ends up this book that he has given us to help us understand him and help us to visualize his way of life. It's a city It's a tabernacle. It's a visualization. I've asked Mr. Weber to play a song to tie this all together. This is a song from the revival of the musical Godspell. It's written by Stephen Schwartz, and it's called Beautiful City. And don't be turned off by the word City of Man, because the point is it's something that we have to see and something that we have to work together to build. We do know that it's the city of God, but I just like the way that Stephen Schwartz ties it all together in this song, The Beautiful City.